Welcome, welcome. You're listening to the hashtag SDR Ask podcast.
Oh, there's a new twist there.
This is Amy Hall, and with me is Greg Kokel. He's here to answer your questions.
Well, hello, hello. Greg. Ready, ready, ready.
All right. I'll ask
Set
you the
to
first
go,
question.
Go, go. I like that.
But yes, I'm only going to ask you once, so.
Okay.
All right. This comes from Emily Steele.
All right.
In a fallen world, there are many genetic abnormalities that we can now correct with medicine and or surgery.
Mm-hmm.
If our souls are gendered, could it be that a female soul could actually attach to a male physical body? If this could happen, then would it be sinful to correct the physical body to match the soul's gender?
Well, this is an interesting question. I'm not sure how the first part of the comment relates to the second part. I mean, because we can do genetic engineering, blah, blah, blah. Is he saying because if we give primacy to the soul, then we can genetically change the body?
She's saying that there are genetic abnormalities that we correct now. So that's an analogy to saying if there is the wrong gendered soul attached to a body of the opposite gender.
Well, this is a more of a theological, metaphysical question. I don't think you can do that. And it has to do with how one understands the origin of the soul. And there are basically two views. And on either view, theological view of the origin of soul, this wouldn't make any sense. So one is the creationist view of the soul, and that is the view that God creates the soul, that the parents make the body, and God creates the soul. And then there's a question is, when does God put the soul in the body, so to speak? I mean, that might be a discussion on that view. But in any event, it is God making the soul and putting the soul in the body. So God's not going to put the wrong soul in the body, okay? That's not my view, by the way. And I do think it raises a question about how the soul gets fallen. You know, if God's creating the soul, he's not going to create a fallen soul, individually create souls and then kind of put them in the body. That's a view, though. That's a respectable view. It's within the pale. But you can see how this circumstance could not really apply on the creationist view of the soul. The second view is the traducian view of the soul. And the traducian view is that that human beings reproduce themselves. They reproduce according to their own kind. They reproduce other human beings. A human being is a bipart being. It is a being that has a substance, a soul that's a substance, and a body that's a substance. It's a complete thing. It's not a quality that the body has. It's a separate thing. And this is why the soul can go somewhere else than the body is through out-of-body experiences or dying and going to heaven or to hell or whatever. And so if the human being is creating the soul, then the soul, it makes sense then if the human is fallen, reproduces fallen human beings, then it can I'm pausing here because something else is occurring to me. I'll say it in a moment. Then it's going to reproduce the whole human being, which body and soul are going to be fallen. I guess this does raise the question in principle, could then the reproduced soul be the wrong gender for the body? So maybe on that view, one might suggest the possibility of the wrong gender. But I don't think so. Now, why don't I think so? I'm not sure how to characterize that, but because the generation, I guess what I want to say is that the generation of the human being is going to be a real human being. Human beings are gendered in a binary fashion, and the soul that is made goes with the body that's made. Just like maybe to use a bizarre illustration, you wouldn't have a birth a human being that has a goat's head, because humans don't have goat's heads, they have a human head. So the human being is going to have the parts that are appropriate for human beings, even though those individual parts are soiled in a sense, it's all going to be the appropriate human parts. Maybe that's the way I'd want to put it. And so you're going to have a male human being with a male human soul, both body and soul influenced by the fall. But you're not going to get some kind of totally different soul that's appropriate for the body. You're not going to get a goat soul in a human body, for example. That's, to me, that's the most parsimonious way of looking at it. And if you start suggesting these other bizarre possibilities, like, well, because we're fallen, then we maybe have the wrong gendered soul that gets produced, then I could say, well, maybe we could have the wrong natured soul as well. And so we could have a human body with a rabbit soul or something like that. And so this seems to me to multiply and complicate the issue far beyond what's necessary for explanatory power or for adequate explanation of man's fallenness and man's wholeness at the same time. So to be a unified human being, the body and the soul go together. And the sickness is when the soul is confused and has dysphoria about that appropriate connection and then wants to change the body to match the confused soul instead of change the perspective of the soul to match the body. One other thing, too, is that these things seem to be developmental. There is no evidence that these kinds of things are constitutional. That is, when you're born with the wrong soul, okay? These things seem to be things that are affected by circumstances in the environment that result in the dysphoria about one's gender. So that would be evidence that it's developmental, and it is not the case that the wrong soul is in the body, the wrong kind of soul.
I also think it...
gendered soul.
This question reflects a view of the body and soul as being more separated than they actually are, as if they're coming from two different places.
Right.
When they're actually one created thing and two aspects of that one created thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's more Cartesian in its approach, where Descartes saw these radically different things kind of incidentally joined in a certain sense, where I think the Christian biblical view is more holistic, like you said, and even though we can talk about them as separate and then one physical, non-physical, the union is so deep and so profound that they go together in a richer way than what mm-hmm. Descartes characterized. And with that in mind, it would be much less likely to think about the wrong soul in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good point.
All right, the next question comes from Kristen Fulton. Cain kills his brother in cold blood and lies to God about it, but God only banishes him and protects him from being killed by people with a mark. Should God's handling of this influence how Christians feel about capital punishment?
No, and I'll tell you why. What God chooses to do in his own court is up to him. He has his own set of prerogatives and his own reasons for doing what he does. Soon after that incident, at least with regards to the biblical record, I don't know time-wise how long, but in Genesis 9, God makes a directive regarding capital punishment. And he says there, if man sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God, God created man. So in the case of Cain, you really have no social order in place. Okay, you don't have governments in place and all that. You've got very beginnings of things. And we have a clear picture there that what Cain did was wrong. Now, why did God protect him in that way? I mean, that's beyond me right now, and I'd have to look at the text and whatever. And it would all be conjecture anyway. What we do know is that in the biblical record, in terms of salvation history and all this stuff unfolding, God does give a directive after the flood, and that is a directive that pertains specifically to capital punishment. So he gives a responsibility of others to act this way towards man killers, human murderers, basically. And there's a reason for it, and it's the image of God in man. And so if one, if you are an image destroyer, then your life is forfeit for doing it that way. That's similar. That's consistent with the biblical guideline of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And just so people don't misunderstand that, that is not meant to promote the concept of personal revenge. That's what had been made of it that Jesus was trying to correct. Originally, it's a concept of justice. that the punishment must fit the crime. And that's the principle of lex talionis, the law of the claw, because that whatever punishment is meted out should fit the crime that was committed, and a life for a life in this case, and that was established early on in Genesis 9. And so that's why I think God can do what he wants in his court. But, and by the way, it turns out that David was responsible for the death of Uriah, but with his adultery with Bathsheba, but God didn't demand his life there. But as far as humans are to make their decision, God authorized capital punishment in that circumstance.
We all deserve capital punishment for rebellion against God, and
yeah,
he doesn't
right.
he doesn't bring about that punishment yet.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Capital in a different sense. I mean, we all are going to die, but then we have eternal death, separation from God. But it, as a in a certain sense, as a policy issue, this is really a question of policy, and it does seem like public policy, how governments are to comport themselves, and this seems to be a justification of the legitimacy of capital punishment for capital crimes that we see in Genesis 9. And we are not invited to mimic the behavior of God when he dealt with Cain. That's his business, but he gave us this guideline for ours.
It's also one single example in the Bible, whereas in the law and through the rest of the Old Testament, he reiterates this law.
Not only that one, there are over 20 crimes that are capital crimes, and half of them are religious crimes in the Mosaic law. Mm-hmm. So God is not against capital punishment, and anybody who argues that is just not, they're not, I think they're not using the scripture accurately. And what they seize upon is something Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount as to disqualify all the rest. So anyway, that's another issue. But
and even in the New Testament, Paul talks about in Romans 13, the government does not bear the sword for nothing.
Yeah.
It's the agent of God's wrath.
Yeah.
So
they're not spanking them with the sword.
Yeah.
And Paul does say, too, in the book of Acts, he said, if I have done anything worthy of death, then I do not refuse to die. So the problem there is not capital punishment in what Paul was facing. It was whether capital punishment was just with regards to the alleged crimes. Mm-hmm. That he committed, or the crimes that he allegedly committed.
All right, the next question comes from Nathan Rumpf. Is it wrong for Christians to save for retirement when we could be feeding starving people with that money?
Well, no, I don't think it is. And I guess the question that I would ask is, why would it be wrong? Why would it be wrong? I mean, what would be the moral principle that would inveigh against us saving for retirement? Yes, we could be feeding starving children, but starving people, but if we don't take care of ourselves, then we may end up being among the starving people that someone else has to take care of. It says in maybe 2 Thessalonians that if, where there are two places in the New Testament that speak to this directly, and one of them is 2 Thess, so and I think one of them may be in Titus or somewhere like that. But just going generally from memory, if a person does not provide for his own, then he is worse than an unbeliever. That's what Paul says regarding. And there's another passage that said we should provide for our own and then essentially have enough left over to help other people. So we individually have a responsibility to make sure that our needs are covered, and if we have an obligation to help others, then we should be living below our means so we can help those who are in genuine need. We do not construct a circumstance which pushes us in genuine need, in which we have to then rely on other people, okay? Proverbs makes it really clear that and there's a couple of different ones that refer to the responsibility that we have of managing our own affairs such that our temporal needs are taken care of. And illustrations are made of ants and squirrels and gophers and stuff like that, you know, different ones, about providing this need. You know, don't be indolent. Don't be lazy. Don't put your hand in the dish and not bring it back to your mouth. I mean, there's a whole bunch of passages. But the overriding principle is one of industry, in which you're looking to the future to provide for your needs so you won't be in want. And that's exactly what's mm-hmm. going on when people are saving for their retirement.
And it's certainly not either or. You can save for retirement and you can help starving people.
Sure. Yeah. It's not one or the other. Excellent.
All right. The next question comes from I Need to Go Fishing.
And he asks, his name? That's his moniker
that's
there?
That's his Twitter name. Yes.
Well, I relate to that.
Can an eternal God ever really die, even in human form?
Well, see, here's a category mistake, I think. The person is confusing something and asking the wrong kind of question, okay, about that thing. So the answer, simply put, is an eternal God cannot die. That is, God, in his essential nature, cannot die, okay? Can God take on a human nature, which includes a human body, that is contingent, that could die? And the answer is yes, but the thing that dies is the human body, not the divine nature. And so this is why we make this distinction in the person of Jesus, hypostatic union, that he is fully, that he is, that he has the combined natures of God and man. Now, this is kind of mysterious, but the classical formula for that is it's called the
Chalcedonian box.
Yeah, the Chalcedonian formula in the Chalcedonian box. Senior moment there, which is that Jesus is fully God and fully man. He is one person with two natures. So those are the four sides of the box: fully God, fully man, one person, two natures. Now, anything within that box, that's orthodoxy. And different people have moved around and focused a little bit more on one rather than the other. So you've got theology, you got Christology from above, which is the Western Church. You got Christology from below that emphasizes the human nature. That's the Eastern Church. But that's still within the pale. Now, when we understand it that way, then there's no problem, as suggested by Wants to Go Fishing, or whatever his name is. Because we make this clear distinction between the human nature, the divine nature. The human nature is immortal. I'm sorry, the divine nature is immortal, but the human nature is not immortal. It's mortal and therefore can die.
What makes it hard to understand is, or maybe not understand, but to grasp what this means, is Jesus is only one person. He's one person and he's two natures. So as, you know, being truly human, he also has a human soul, correct?
Mm-hmm.
But he's one person. And this is where it's hard to make sense of this.
Right, right. And this is where some people come up with, different views about how this all works out. I mean, my basic take on it is that the person is the second person of the Trinity that takes on the human nature. So the one person is the divine person, the divine word, who then has inherently and eternally the divine nature and adds to him a human nature. So when we say he's 100% God and 100% man, we don't mean he's 200%. We mean that everything that is true of man is true of Jesus. All of those qualities that are inherently human and all of those qualities that are inherently divine are true of the one individual, Jesus of Nazareth. And is it a mystery? Yeah, it's a big mystery. It's just hard to comprehend. This is why, I'll go so far in trying to work these things out. And then I just stop and I'm fine with just, I don't know. Other people can work harder on it, but I'm just an MA, not a PhD. So I'm not going to drill deeper. A lot of times I think people get themselves in trouble when they try to do that. They start getting creative and then they're proud of their creativity and then they dig a big hole for themselves, and they can't get out. So I'm just going to leave it there and say, wow, that's really weird and
it's
wonderful.
Hard.
At
we
the
have
same
nothing
time.
To compare it to, so it's hard to
right. It's
hard to kind of visualize it, I
guess. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well, that's all we have time for today, Greg. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Send in your questions on Twitter using the hashtag STRAsk. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.